so I'm just going to like briefly introduce. Firstly, I'm going to introduce the topic, and then it's going to be split into kind of three parts. So, like, part A, we'll look at Hanuman's liminal flight in the Ramayana. And then the second part, we'll look at Hanuman theologically as a kind of Axis Mundi kind of figure. And then finally, I'm kind of placing it in a social context, looking at the idea of Balaji possession in Mendipur in India. So yeah, I'm just going to just begin by saying that, So soaring 91 feet above the North Indian skyline, this monumental statue of Hanuman at the Chatpur Temple in New Delhi highlights the continuing presence of the monkey deity in the 21st century Hindu religious imagination. Such pervasive colossal images, according to a local ashram owner, envision Hanuman standing for all time as a westerly gatekeeper for India's capital so that invaders cannot attack. Clearly, in this instance, a mediatory garden-like connotation is attributed to the monkey, which, as Walcott observes, derives from his functionality as a supernatural messenger and cosmic voyager between differing existential worlds within the Ramayana of Valmiki. Lutgendorf, a renowned scholar on Hanuman, perceives that such monumental boundary-marking statue structures of Hanuman in the landscape inextricably relate to ideas concerning the liminal associations ascribed universally to the monkey figure. Jarrow, Lutgendorf, and Smith agree that Hanuman, as a character of the Ramayana narrative, possesses all of the characteristics of a quasi-shaman, specifically through a series of magical flights he ventures upon to unknown lands to access medicinal and herbal plants which are beyond the reach of mundane and divine beings alike. Constantly expanding on the ideologies of the aforementioned scholars, I will argue that Hanuman's monkey-like liminal nature is not only anchored within the literary boundaries of the Ramayana, but that his shamanesque qualities extend and are evident on both cosmic and social levels. For means of clarification, I will use the term liminal mediator in relation to Hanuman's cosmic nature. As to reductively deem Hanuman a shaman is highly problematic, because as a taxonomy within the field of anthropology of religion, shamanism is extremely broad, utilized to, I quote, refer to many different phenomena, some of which bear little relationship to any original derivation. In brief, this paper will consider Hanuman's liminality in relation to the following issues: the mythological flight of Hanuman in the Ramayana, Hanuman as a cosmic Axis Mundi, and Hanuman invoked in healing exorcism rituals manifested in his Balaji persona. It is interesting to note that, like many other heroic narratives, for example, the primordial strength of Heracles in Greek mythology, Hanuman's liminal qualities stem unquestionably from events of his divine conception, birth, and infancy, as documented in the Ramayana. Consistent with this, Lutgendorf conceived that such deities, namely Hanuman and Skanda, were physically conceived by divine entities, are second-generation gods, who, like humans, are naturally born, and that their genetic genealogical descent is indicative of their subsequent characters and natures. The birth narrative specific to Hanuman recount that the monkey child was the offspring of both Anjana and the wind god Vayu, who forcibly seduced her. The fact that he was genetically derived from Vayu, the wind, later serves as an explanatory device for his adolescent shamanic ability to fly, as, I quote, Hanuman declared that only he himself, his father, Vayu, and Garuda are capable of crossing the ocean in this manner. With this gift of flight, it is said that the hungry infant Hanuman leapt at the height of the sun in order to eat it, where Indra, I quote, was filled with rage and hurled his thunderbolt at you. Then, as you fell on the mountain peak, your jaw was broken on the left side, and that is why you were named Hanuman, that is, broken jaw. Anatomical disfigurement, such as Hanuman's jaw, seems to feature widely in academic literature on shamans, where, as Schmidt illustrates, only physically deformed children born with teeth or six fingers, for example, are likely candidates for the shamanic calling. Upon knowing of this vicious act of deforming inflicted on his child, Vayu requested that Indra repay him through infusing in Hanuman numerous supernatural traits or boons, Indra supplying him with the capability to only die when he so wished, and Brahma, the god of creation, ensured that he could not be killed by any human-made arm. Finally, Vayu gifts Hanuman with the power to rid malevolent ghosts and spirits through his commemoration. This process of painful disfigurement and consequent rewards of new enchanted capabilities can be viewed as bordering synonymous frameworks of shamanic initiation, where violent liminal period represented by a severed jaw stimulates the creation of a figure blessed with magical properties. Schmidt referring to Peruvian shamanic initiatory ritual states, the shaman's frightening experience becomes something different and more rewarding. He has the ability to take a magical fright, just as he did before, but now he can handle it. Evidently, these episodes of conception, initiation, and this motif of magical flight, and their association with classical accounts of intercosmic shaman experience are, as Jarrow stresses, numerous and too detailed to ignore. This magical flight across the vast ocean, or as Jarrow calls Hanuman's shamanic flight, is one of the major evidentiary contributors to my argument envisioning Hanuman as a liminal mediator. Characteristic of this ecstatic flight is its turbulent and fluctuating nature, where Hanuman shapeshifts, ascends and descends frequently. Even prior to the voyage itself, it is stated that, and so frightened birds shattering trees with his chest and slaughtering many animals, the wise, resolute monkey freely ranged the lapis-hued meadows. It is a scene of utter pandemonium akin in Jarrow's interpretation to be the pre-chaotic imagery which induces shamanic visionary experiences. Moreover, it is the power of his manas, or mind, that Hanuman's magical boons are activated. There is thus an underlying cognitive dimension which underscores his capabilities. For example, in the orchard of Ashoka, Hanuman, in a meditational state, attempts to pinpoint the exact location of Sita. Although Jarrow makes several connections between Hanuman and shamans in his essay, he stresses the monkey does not constitute an existential equivalent of a human shaman, but that his magic intermediary role is assigned to his association with the liminal monkey, who would later be embodied as a deity. What is interesting about Hanuman's flight is that it's conceived as a zigzag mode of travel, diving to the depths of the ocean and ascension to the heights of the sky, where he, echo, continued on his way with tremendous speed, flying through the great fretwork of waves in the salty ocean as if to count them. Seeing that tiger among monkeys flying through the sky, the sea serpents took him for Suparna. Simultaneous ascension and descent is indicative to his aerodynamic movements. It is claimed that figures devoid of supernatural traits are unable to see him, only sea serpents and other celestial beings. Thus, Jarrow states, like the shaman, Hanuman flies undetected. When he arrives at Lanka and finds Sita, because of her preoccupation with Dharma, she cannot fly back with Hanuman as he is another man. However, Hanuman acting as an intermediary between Sita and the distant Rama sends messages and jewels back and forth to Rama psychically. After being captured by the malevolent Ravana, Hanuman sets fire to the Isle of Lanka using his tail, said to be resultant of the Tejas, or internal power of Rama. This scene corresponds perfectly with Eliade's understanding of the shamanic figure as the master of fire. Speaking of Eliade, he perceived in his modus classical work that shamans are inherently psychopomp by nature, meaning that they can assume the form of birds. Sundarakanda 150 represents Garuda and Hanuman as being of the same essence, and such an affiliation mirrors that of a messenger emulating his Garuda flight. Luskendorf brings to the fore that, unlike the monistic Sri Vaishnava sect, who claim Garuda as the only sufficient divine messenger, the dualistic Madhvas envisage that Hanuman, drawing on his identification with Vayu, developed a theology in which, as both the universal wind and life breath within the human body, Hanuman was cosmic intermediary par excellence. Shedding light on this Garuda Hanuman as a messenger dichotomy, Aniku Tierney, in her book Monkey is Mirror, suggested dualistic cosmological systems function so that, like yin and yang, one category weaves within another. In brief, she states that this fluidity between categories of being is, in most cases, embodied by the presence of an ambiguous mediator-like figure. Hanuman, within the context of the Madhava's dualistic cosmos, is ideal as a manifestation of this liminal mediator. For monkeys, both mark and potentially threaten boundaries between categories of being. In hindsight, Hanuman's intercessor functionalities, assuming cosmic intercessors, echoed in mythological metaphors likening him to a mountain, a physical symbol of the state described as the Axis Mundi, or the liminal center of the world. So, illuminating conspicuously within the Ramayana mythology is the centrality of the master figure of Hanuman to the narrative itself. Indeed, Jarrow states, I quote, without Hanuman and the monkey kingdom, both Ravana's domain and Sita are inaccessible to conventional human powers. These mythological accounts of the feats, exploits, and inherent nature of Hanuman form a foundational basis for much later ideologies relating to him. For example, quote, as the demon slayer protector, granter of boons, divine messenger and intermediary, physical and psychic healer, and the exemplar of the qualities of Shakti and Bhakti. Bob has considered this multifaceted nature surrounding Hanuman in relation to popular Hindu belief, stating that his apotropaic power originates from semen retention as a consequence of his celibate existence. Such his utter devotion for Ram obliterates these instinctual drives. Consequently, Hanuman becomes a figure much revered by brahmacharyas who idolize him as the quintessential devotee. In this regard, Hanuman clearly becomes a figure of full human mimicry. It is precisely for this reason it could be argued that he is popular in contemporary Hindu tradition. Elaborating on this issue, Alter states, I quote, Hanuman is perhaps unique in the Hindu pantheon insofar as he represents a spiritual method rather than a spiritual goal. He provides a model for living a virtuous life. The divine monkey, although representative of supernatural divinity, has one foot firmly grounded in the mundane world. Moreover, Bob believes this to be the explanation why he's worshipped before deities and visions superior in the pantheon, such as Vishnu. He functions as an access point for humanity, an approachable intercessor in which to communicate with the higher, less accessible figures of divinity. This communicative ease tied to the affable figure of Hanuman stems from his linguistic capability as a simian in the Ramayana to both speak and understand human languages, although Sanskrit is proficient. His linkage with the mundane world has been expressed in physical terms, where akin to the Axis Mundi, which is elementally manifested as a concrete physical feature, for example, a tree, a mountain, or a ladder, Hanuman possesses a solidified physical body within the world. It has been suggested that he appears during this Kali Yuga in multiple forms wherever the story of Ramayana is recited. Some devotees go as far as to say that Kurt Hanuman is not limited by space or embodiment. He can take any shape and go anywhere at will. Being a second-generation deity, according to Afflati, his conception may have encompassed the sexual interpolation of more than just Vayu, because the motif of the cosmic movement of divine seed is commonplace in South Asian mythologies. In the Shiva Purana, for example, the conception of Hanuman assumes another level of meaning, that the seed of Shiva said to be inherited and transported in Vayu's womb during this copulation with Anjana. Both Alter and Ruskindorf, from this observation, hypothesize that Hanuman thus constitutes a unifying composite being, encompasses the Shakti of several deities in one existential body. In essence, Hanuman becomes the middle ground between two devotional belief systems in contemporary Hindu tradition, the Vaishnavas and the Shaivas. For instance, in the Narayana Mahapurana, Simi describes Hanuman as a dual avatar, Vishnu and Shiva. At a deeper theological level, moreover, this dualistic embodiment of Shaiva or Vaishnava becomes a manifestation of the ideological principles they represent, Bhakti and Shakti simultaneously. Ruskindorf argues that the increasingly acknowledgeable Panjmukhi Hanuman depiction of the five-headed Hanuman in this multiple form of five signifies a cosmic totality. It also indicates the amalgamation of these Vaishnava Shaiva and Indrishan Tantric elements. It accounts as a visual theology which, a quote, displays a god who manages to be at once Vaishnava, Shaiva, and Tantric, a minor and subaltern turned middle class deity caught in the act of assuming an integral and encompassing role. The Vaishnava Bhakti and Shaiva Shakti intertwine in Hanuman because through his undying devotion for Ram, he activates Shakti crevices hidden within his divinely constrained body. Bhakti and Shakti, usually conceived as disparate qualities, interplay and perform harmoniously under the liminal guise of Hanuman. Alter believes that North Indian wrestlers turn to Hanuman for this reason. He serves as a wrestler paradigm par excellence, a mediating symbol through which human actions can be regarded as divine Shakti. Hanuman thus equates as a model through which wrestlers can empathize and consequently activate the Shakti bound in their bodies through their Bhakti to Hanuman. The idealized monkey in these wrestler communities is depicted as a muscular, warrior-like human-animal hybrid, a mace in one hand and a mountain in the other. Although Hanuman, mythologically speaking, is purely simian in form, I suggest that precise preoccupation and association with the mundane world has been subject of much as Bob labels human emulation in wrestler and Vaishnava Shaiva tantric traditions, in which stimulates this almost necessity to depict him as more anthropomorphic in 21st century popular Hindu poses. Walcott argues in line with this that Hanuman, pivoting between Bhakti and Shakti, is analogous with the concepts of Dharma and Ritha, given that he is the actual embodiment of cosmic stability. Hanuman's liminal axis mundi location between divine and human worlds becomes sociologically manifest in the ritualism of Balaji temples located in Mendipur, where the divine simeon transforms into kind of exorcist-like being in order to cure cases of malevolent spirit possession. Oh, sorry, I'm going a bit fast. Sorry.
Now and then.
Yeah, really sorry.
It's really good. But
yeah, yeah. Kakar, in his monumental work on Balaji, healing in Manipur, entitled Shamans, Mystics and Doctors, describes rather vividly the grim ambiance of possession states, especially that of women confined within the temple boundaries. The women write in pain, ecstatically somersaulting, and the Buddha compelling the victims to shove vulgarities are just some of the scenes he mentions. These dangerous spirit agents termed Buddha Pratha are understood as limbo-like between the boundaries of the human loka and the ancestral world. Such confused beings feel unfulfilled without the human body, hence they possess other humans in order to satisfy the void. Kakar neatly states that the, I quote, psychological proximity is due to the fact that these spirits, occupying the lowest rungs in the Hindu hierarchy of supernatural beings, are closest to the human state. But one question arises from this. How does Hanuman, / Balaji, fit into this complex equation? Indeed, Hanuman's healing properties stem unequivocally from his boon of immortality, and consequent courage imbued in his essence by Brahma and the Ramayana. For example, in the Anda Ramayana, quote, men will worship your image to soothe their afflictions, and when you are remembered, ghosts, goblins, and ghouls will flee. Kathari, thinking on a more sophisticated trail of thought, believes that Hanuman invoked in these instances of possession functions in his virile mode, or Hanuman view. Considered a more tribal form, it is anchored in the notion that he is a leader of a group of Bhavan Vir, or 52 warriors who are masters in the slaying of demons and yoginis, or 64 demonesses. In this emanation, Hanuman is believed to be dark and inherently dangerous, and it is this darkness which in effect determines the efficacy of the ritual healing self. Therefore, as Lutgendorf brings to light, it is precisely his resemblance to darkness with his ailing beliefs that stimulates an almost homeopathic medical effect, like cures like. Hanuman, in most circumstances, is not directly the possession subject of the healer, but a series of benevolent dutes or messenger spirits commanded by his supreme authority. In his Balaji persona, Hanuman is a flag of representation for these liminal healing spirits, insofar as, I quote, The power healers believe and are believed by many others to possess is thought to come directly from Hanuman. Balaji possession is induced through a chain-like process, where laddus, or food offerings, are touched by the idol of Balaji, then by the priest, and then these blessed mortals are ingested by the victim. As I foresaid, the simeon reveals himself wherever the Ramayana is recited. The kin of the victim are expected to read chapters in their honour to ensure his appearance. These haphazard appearances of the monk is characteristic of his sentient being, and rise the phenomenon known as Hanuman avatars, where it is believed that the person firstly becomes Hanuman, imitating his simian-like demeanour. One example of this is a holy man in the 17th century, Devanath Maharaj, who used to be, I quote, behave like a madman and leap from tree to tree, announcing that he had the answer of the monkey within him. Such ecstatic behaviour undeniably expresses the existential categorical fluidity between divinity and humanity. So then I argue from the philosophical intercalation of selves in an ultimate reality. And the simian halfway deity acts as a communicative element between these categories. As Oniku Tierney emphasises, the monkey serves as a metaphor for humanity, such that healers must become boundarymen like their much-loved Balaji. Conclusion. Right. So having explored the varying levels in which Hanuman exhibits a liminal mediator,
Well, I just have to remember what was on. Anyway, screen.
Yeah.
Ah,
great.
It's great,
yeah.
So Hammond explored the varying levels in which Hanuman exhibits a liminal mediator status. I've come to the conclusion, elaborating on the ideologies of many scholars, that his mediatory role is highly multifaceted. What I am suggesting that his liminal position functions on four differing levels of polarities. The mythological, so the shaman fights between Rama and Sita. Ideological, between the idealized qualities of Bhakti and Shakti. Social, between Vaishnava and Shaiva devotees. And cosmic, between human and divine, through possessions of Quasi Axis Mundi. I believe his role as intercessor springs from his therianthropic nature. Although some argue he's not a therianthrope at all, but a divine monkey. I suggest that his mythological connection with human emotions, Bhakti primarily, languages, behaviour, his attachment to the physical world via possession and the like, which affects an almost kind of theranthropic affiliation to the intricately construed monkey deity. So just kind of summing up quite nicely, I've got a quotation by Friedrich Smith from Self-Possessed, and he stated, "It is no wonder that, as a thoroughly virtuous expert in shamanic travel, he is invoked, even possessed by devotees, wrestlers, healers, and those in need of otherworldly assistance, and that as Balaji he presides over an ever-expanding horde of dudes who, like him, are healing spirits." And yeah.
Thank you very much for that lesson. So now we put it to the audience, if there are any. 10 minutes we're allowing for questions. I know it's not very much, but...
Yeah.
I have a question. Yeah. I really enjoyed it. Thank you. There's more. That's all I had to say. Well, I found the textual and the theological elements of your analysis very clear, and I found it really fascinating.
Right, yeah.
And I'm eager to hear more about the third aspect that you mentioned in your abstract, the ethnographic methodologies, the sense of to what extent this vision of Hanuman is self-conscious or present in Hindu methods of worship. So could you explore that a little bit more?
As in, kind of, what I looked at specifically was Balaji possession in Mendipur in this paper.
Okay.
And kind of what I suggested was looking kind of theologically and textually that he is a kind of Axis Mundi kind of figure. That's the reason why he is kind of almost this figure of possession. That makes sense, kind of, because he is liminal and it's so ambiguous that he can kind of access, like, he's like in between, he pivots between the two, and that's why he's so perhaps effective in Balaji healing.
Okay. And so to what extent is the approach that the scholarship that you're summarizing, to what extent, if any, is there a division between that attitude towards Hanuman's liminality and that practiced, that manifested through the practices themselves?
So how it's kind of... So could you explain...
Oh, yeah, sure. To what extent is the this aspect of Hanuman, do you think, that's represented through scholarship?
Yeah.
Is there, if any... I don't want to say a disconnect, but a contrast between how scholarship is approaching this liminality of Hanuman and that is manifested in the practices of Hindu worship.
So how Hindus see Hanuman, you mean? Mm-hmm. I'm not sure.
Or do you think it's important? I mean, I just...
Yeah, obviously it's important. It's... I've just gone blank, sorry.
No, don't worry.
Yeah, I think it is important that it is kind of... I think Lutzkendorf goes on about a lot of how he uses interviews as well with practitioners, and obviously this kind of liminal aspect is kind of present there as well in what... through this kind of ethnographic interviews.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's an important aspect that you actually... Not only textually is it important and kind of shown textually and theologically, but also through the practitioners themselves, through interviews and ethnographies, and they see him as a liminal being also.
Okay.
You said at the start that the use of the term shaman or shaman was problematic, but then you went on to and it's also in your conclusion about Hanuman's shamanistic light. But I was wondering if you can elaborate in what sense.
What I mean is that shamanism as a kind of in academia, I think, is quite problematic because it can kind of relate to not only shamans, say, for example, indigenous shamans in a particular cultural milieu, for example, in the Amazon, but also can refer to kind of a neo-shamanic kind of view where it's kind of more cognitive rather than practical. So that's what I was trying to say, that shamanism is problematic as a kind of idea. And I think it's a bit kind of... and also Jaro, one of the people on the list, stated that shaman, to say he is a shaman is problematic because it's more like a shamanic flight. He uses the techniques, but he's not himself kind of a shaman, if that makes sense.
Hanuman is using the techniques.
Yeah, similar techniques, but he's not actually a shaman. That makes sense. So he uses the term shamanic flight, or shamanic figure in his work. I think it's called Hanuman as a Shamanic Figure. And I think initially he did call his paper Hanuman a Shaman, but I think he found problems with the shamanic taxonomy.
Just to follow that up, I think it's really helpful the way you're bringing in to highlight how the Siddha yogi, like yoga as a Siddha tradition, and that whole Shakti tradition, really is pretty shamanic. And it's I like that done with the Hanuman figure. But the question, there's always this question about what actual shaman this might relate to, or what actual shamanic traditions it might relate to. And I think your comment that it's a style within the yogic Shakti deity traditions is really helpful, rather than it kind of particular tradition. But maybe just to relate it to David Gordon White and Staneshwar Timarsina, who both talked about tantric shamanism.
Right, yeah.
And the ways in which shamanism can come in through the sort of tantric yogic tradition. Maybe.
Oh, wow. That's interesting. I'm not familiar with the work, but okay.
They're trying to trace actual connections to actual shamanic elements historically.
Oh, right, okay.
Provide some source for that.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, cheers. Thank you for that. Yeah.
Just for each other question.
Oh, sorry.
Oh, thank you. I don't know. I think you spoke to this a little bit, but I wasn't really clear. So what significance do you think his particular bodily form as, you know, a monkey, say, rather than another sort of animal pictorially, in terms of how he's represented, what significance does that have to his status as a liminal being,
I think...
being a primate rather than being like a bear,
Right. I think it relates... a lot of ethnographic work has been done on the ideas of monkey in a kind of cross-culturally. I think monkeys are naturally kind of liminal in their essence, and that they're like kind of almost, you know, we are derived, you know, well, tech, you know,
yes.
Kind of, oh, it's like problematic. So, but yeah.
Well, it seems like there's this nascent sort of theory of human evolution, maybe, that's already like.
I think the monkey, obviously, there's a really good book by Aniko Tierney. She's an anthropologist. She did the book, it's in On the Reading List, Monkey's Mirror, and she kind of relates the monkeys in Japanese history and culture are very kind of important as figures of devotion, and how they've changed historically depending on kind of changes in cosmology. So changes in cosmology affect how the figures are viewed as well, the monkey. So the monkey, for instance, at one point in Japanese history was a kind of trickster figure, kind of clown-like figure, according to Aniko Tierney, and then at some other point where there was a change in the cosmological underlay later on in history, I don't know exactly, but he becomes a more kind of a mediator between deities. So there's always like this change based on cosmological underlay. So yeah.
You can get the same with foxes, because foxes sound like humans when they shout.
Yeah. I've read a bit about foxes as well. Yeah, it's great.
Yeah, so. They do. There was one outside my house, and I hear this baby weeping and crying into the night.
Yeah.
Fox. Mm-hmm.
Any more questions? Otherwise, I think Well, thank you very much for that, Matt. And I guess we'll wrap it up here and we'll pass it over to Ben.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.